Criminalizing protest in Florida, COVID's impact on education, and a college class on psychedelics. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor DeSantis is pushing his plan to increase penalties for people who protest and are involved in any looting or attacks on police. This comes in response to the Black Lives Matter marches from last summer. We'll get an update on the bill following last month's attack on the Capitol. Also, how much is at-home learning affecting your kids? There's a new statewide project called Class of COVID-19. It's a look at how the pandemic has impacted the way kids learn and, in some cases, are not learning. And finally, could psychedelic mushrooms or LSD be useful for those suffering from PTSD? All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Protesting has been an essential part of American democracy since its founding. The First Amendment of our Constitution clearly states, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. Yet your right to protest in Florida may be coming under fire. Legislation proposed by Governor Ron DeSantis last year would raise the penalty for protesters found blocking streets, damaging property, or intimidating law enforcement. The governor has argued the bill is meant to target what he calls rioters, not peaceful protesters. Civil rights advocates believe it's criminalizing civil disobedience. Anna Ceballos is a reporter for the Miami Herald based in Tallahassee, and she joins us now to better understand what's going on with this. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's briefly go back to where this bill, this proposal came from. It was late last year after the Black Lives Matter protests that occurred around the nation. But who launched this idea? Was it just Governor DeSantis or were there other people involved?
The timing is important. The governor first proposed this proposal in September. It was in the heat of the 2020 election as Trump was running for re-election, and DeSantis, who's a very strong ally of the president, was, you know, working to deliver the state to Trump. And eventually he did. But the point is that while there is really no direct indication that Trump was involved at all with the bill that is now before the Florida legislature, DeSantis and Trump have been aligned in these ideas. So around the time that DeSantis' attorney sent the proposal to the Senate and House to start drafting a bill, that was around, it was in late September of last year. And Trump had already developed, you know, a harsh vocabulary list for those involved in the Black Lives Matter protests. He would call those in the streets thugs and anarchists, terrorists even. So Trump criticized protests in, quote, Democrat-run cities and tweeted that the federal government would send help to clamp down on protests to solve, quote, your problems. So that kind of gives you a sense of what type of proposal maybe Trump would endorse. But again, there's really no indication that he was directly involved in this bill at all. But it's not to say that he might not support the idea.
Have we seen anything like this in any other state?
I believe there is another similar bill floating around, another Republican-controlled legislature. I forget the exact state, but okay. But there are similar proposals moving in other parts of the country. This is not alone.
So this bill went through the House Criminal Justice and Public Safety Subcommittee, I believe, recently. What happened? Mm-hmm.
Right. So that was 2 weeks ago. And, you know, the 60-day legislative session begins in March. So the bills that you're seeing now are almost like the priority, like the top bills. And 2 weeks ago, the bill's first hearing, if there's any indication as to how heated this debate will be, it will be, 2 weeks ago was an indication. It was pretty politically divisive. There were about 70 members of the public that showed up, and most of them were young and Black, and they were slamming the proposal. Democrats and the panel hated it. Republican leaders, you know, have indicated to both chambers that, you know, this is a priority. So it was passed along party lines, meaning, you know, all Democrats voted against it, and then all Republicans voted for it. One House Democrat pointed out that the bill is destined to pass, he told me, and then it's just a matter of how it will look like in the end. So right now, what you're going to be seeing in these committees is just going to be a lot of, a lot of heck over the provisions and trying to just devour the provisions in an argument more as to being able to block it, because Republicans right now just have the majority in both chambers and in all the panels where these bills are going to be heard.
Yeah.
So pretty emotional debate by a lot of speakers, and it was a 2-hour meeting.
You know, and as you said, I mean, critics have claimed that this law would unjustly target communities of color, but did anything change within the law or in DeSantis's attitude after the attack on the Capitol, where you saw a group of mostly white Trump supporters attacking and trying to basically pull off a coup on the verification of the election results? Did anything change after that?
Well, remember the timing is again important. While the proposal was rolled out by the DeSantis for the first time after the summer protest of Black Lives Matter, these two identical bills in the House and the Senate were filed at the same time on the night of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. DeSantis and Republican leaders pretty much expedited the filing of the bills. We already knew that they wanted to do this, but when, it was like the next formal step as to, saying this is official, here's the bills that we're going to be considering this session. And DeSantis said that it was the reason why they were filed that night was evidence that the legislature could not afford to waste any more time to combat rioters and violent mobs as what was seen in the attack of the U.S. Capitol. But Democrats and critics of the bill did point out, we're not going to forget that it was rolled out in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests and during an election season. And they are characterizing the timing of the filing as a rebranding of the measure to maybe try to argue on both sides. But there's still a lot of concern that it will unjustly target communities of color, as we saw in the first hearing.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Anna Ceballos. One of the key issues for this upcoming legislative session, a protest bill spearheaded by Governor Ron DeSantis. We have more information, by the way, about this. It's a 51-page bill on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And in that massive bill, all those 51-plus pages, I believe, what's the most concerning part to critics?
Well, like we were talking about earlier, there was a lot of concern regarding the unjust application of the proposed changes if they do become law, that it would disproportionately impact people of color who exercise their constitutional rights to peacefully assembly. There was one Tampa Democrat, Representative Diane Hart, who said, this bill will do nothing to improve or to make the Black community feel safer. This will only, target people who gather in mass, because the bill, as it is written right now, it is very broad and it includes very harsh penalties for things like blocking a roadway or highway. And because the bill does not define things like what would constitute a riot, it kind of leaves it pretty open-ended, and it's turning to long-standing court rulings that define it as that multiple disturbance of peace by three people or more. So there's a lot of concern as to, what if there is violence by one person, and just because I am in the same block, then I am taken to prison, or I am facing harsher felonies, and then I have that on my record. There's also penalties that, for example, if you damage a memorial and it's more than $200, you could face up to 5 years in prison. So these are things that have been almost like blocking roadways, right? We see that all the time.
And with the blocking the roadways, there was also the controversial part of it back before the election was that, well, if you're in a car and protesters are on the roadway and you feel threatened, then you have the right to defend yourself, which basically what they were saying was, wait a minute, are you saying that motorists are allowed to run over people? And that's not part of it anymore? Has that been removed?
It's not part of the bill anymore, but it was a bullet point before there was any bill, a bullet point in a press release that DeSantis sent out in September.
Okay.
And it didn't make it into the bill, but there's still that it got stuck in people's heads because it sounded like, well, hold on a minute. Like, what do you mean? This could potentially be up for debate that you could do this. So there was a lot of concern regarding that specifically, but it's not in the bill as it's written right now.
So if it gets to the governor without many changes, I mean, what's the likelihood though could be challenged in court?
I think the chances for this one could be pretty high. It's almost like a measure that is, tailor-made for summer co court after session. We see a lot of these lawsuits coming up challenging some of the laws that were passed during session. And while I'm not a lawyer, there are a lot of questions on whether the proposal is constitutional. Republican lawmakers who support the bill, some of them are attorneys and have argued that, that this is that the First Amendment is meant to protect your right to peacefully assembly. It does not allow, for violence. And so this is what it's preventing. But I think that's up to debate. There is also a provision that an association of public defenders is saying that it is unconstitutional because it would take away local governments, what would just the right to determine their own budgets. Any resident challenge provisions about how they fund police,
Right.
that direct correlation to the defund the police.
Because that's been that was one of the big debates, obviously, too, was this defund the police during the Black Lives Matter movement. And so now they're part of this bill would basically allow the state, right, to say to a community, no, you're not allowed to defund the police, which basically is them controlling the budget of a city.
Right, because it leaves it pretty open. It's not like, oh, there's a local official who can do this. It's the bill right now says any resident who's concerned about whatever
I see.
budget they approve, they could file an appeal, and then the governor would consider it, and then that consideration goes to a commission that the governor is part of as well, and the Florida cabinet members, and whatever they say goes. So, there's concern that, well, local governments would be. Potentially, anyone could just challenge their authority, and whether or not that would be constitutional is or allowed under law would be.
This is getting a lot of attention outside of the state. I mean, this is you wrote about. I mean, this is like in pop culture. You had pop star Ariana Grande, who, by the way, who's from Boca Raton, calling for people, hey, call your lawmakers. There's a lot of steam pushing against this bill from outside of Florida.
Yeah, that was I think it was, I don't know, maybe like 3 hours before the first hearing. There was an Instagram story from Ariana Grande pretty much just calling on all her fans, I believe they're called Arianators, I don't know what they're called, to call their Florida representatives to quote stop DeSantis's censorship and repression bill. That's how she characterized it. And it was a post that it was she was sharing a graphic from an advocacy group that is very much against this proposal. So it was more of a share, but she has a pretty wide audience, and she was pretty much calling on everyone, and it appears that it worked because I talked to a few House members, and they were saying, I have never received so many emails and calls. I think one of them says they said they received 400. Another one said they received like 1,000 emails in 2 days. So it looks like they're being swamped with mail.
And I think if I'm not mistaken, she was also a big part of the push for voter registration ahead of the election. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you brought this up in one of your stories. What is doxing? Doxing?
Yeah, doxing. So it's considered the type of cyber harassment. So it refers to like when an individual will gather the personal identification information of a person, like their telephone or email address or home address, and then they post it publicly. So whether it, and it's usually for like malicious purposes to, like, oh, this person's doing something bad. Let's like all expose where they live. And this would be creating a statute that would make that would create penalties for doing that.
And how's that related to this bill?
House Speaker Chris Sprouls, he said that on his opening day when he first addressed lawmakers. He said that it was an issue that was really important to him. And the sponsor of the bill said that, you know, in with social media and cyber intimidation, it's, you know, it's they characterized it as a mob mentality type of cyber harassment. So they're kind of lumping in the mob mentality with that they're using to characterize this proposal. So they're kind of lumping in the cyber mob mentality attacks to this bill.
So my understanding is that the bill is going into another committee probably within the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it could very much based on how fast we're seeing it being considered and everything. And I know that in the Senate, the chairman of the first committee has already expressed openness to considering it. This could very much well be a bill that gets to the floor first week of session in March, given the priority.
Now, the session again begins in just a few weeks, and this is one of the hot ones that everybody's talking about. We'll be watching it carefully. Again, the Miami Herald's Anna Ceballos. You can find more of her reporting on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Anna, always a pleasure. Thank you.
No, thank you. Have a great day.
You too. You know, by the way, you can now stay in touch with us via text. You can join our Sundial Text Club. It's new. I had to tell you about it. Send us your thoughts, your comments, or your questions, and we will get back to you. You also get the opportunity to be involved with the show. Again, join our text club by texting the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Just text the word hello. All right, still to come, COVID in the classroom. We're going to look at how the pandemic has exacerbated the state's educational crisis. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, thousands of children in Florida haven't been inside of a classroom for over a year. Some have attended virtual classes with spotty connections. Some have been skipping school entirely, just choosing to work. And many are struggling to keep up with their schoolwork and are being left behind. Class of COVID-19, an education crisis for Florida's vulnerable students, tells the stories of these students, teachers, and parents. Now, the special radio hour aired this morning at 9. It airs again tonight at 7, also at 6 a.m. on Sunday. And you can also hear it online and read all of the stories in the project. Just go to classofcovid.org. Jessica Bateman is WLRN's education reporter and the project editor for Class of COVID-19. She joins us now. Jessica, congratulations. This is an extensive project.
Thank you very much, Lewis.
You know, the project covers the entire state of Florida. This is not just a South Florida story. You look at a lot of different subjects, students with disabilities, undocumented children, survivors of trauma, a lot. How did you determine the scope for this project and the kind of stories that you wanted to cover?
Well, this project truly came about as a collaboration of public media organizations throughout the state of Florida. Reporters and editors, journalists from around the state were concerned about how dire the situation was becoming in terms of students, and especially those students who were already facing the biggest obstacles to success in school, just in some cases falling off the grid completely. And we felt like together we could do a better and more comprehensive job of telling these stories than we could individually. But one thing that I think is interesting and important to remember is that, you know, if you look through our series and you see, okay, there's a story that's based in Central Florida about the disparities in virtual learning and the digital divide, and there's a story about survivors of the 2018 Parkland shooting and the struggles of recovering from that trauma while also dealing with the isolation of the pandemic, you know, those are based in a place, but you could look at any county in Florida and find examples of students and families and teachers who are recovering from trauma and that is complicated by the pandemic, or students who are struggling to get online, you know. So we were able to zoom in on families and teachers and parents in these different areas, but it's definitely true that you can find all of these problems all over our state.
Yeah. And again, as mentioned, this is not a South Florida story. This project is a statewide collaboration. You know, in the course of your reporting over 2020, what were some of the key problems that you identified with students and teachers and parents within the education system here in Florida?
Well, when the schools shut down in mid-March last year for the first time to slow the spread of the coronavirus, one of the first things that I thought of as an education reporter, and I know that superintendents and principals and parents and teachers were thinking about, was how are we going to make sure that students get fed? You know, one of the things that I think is really highlighted in this project and is a major takeaway, or should be, is that there are a lot of challenges that people face that don't seem to have anything to do with education, but are actually directly related to a child's ability to be successful in school. Having enough food is one of them. And the truth is that schools are a primary source of food for many families. You know, in some of our South Florida school districts, the majority of families qualify for free or discounted lunch. You know, and then after we thought about food, we thought about technology. Okay, well, if we're shifting online, if we're going to be doing virtual classes, what about kids who don't have laptops? What about families with three kids and they only have one laptop? What about access to internet? And even if a family is able to establish those things, you know, for the time being, a lot of families, a lot of parents were losing jobs. Then they might be in a situation where they are facing eviction, or their, you know, children are jumping around from mom and dad's house to grandma's house to a friend's house because of that housing instability. And of course, that affects their ability to get online and stay focused and make progress in learning. So I think it's important to think about transportation, food, access to mental health care, access to health care, you know, all of those things as directly related to education.
And again, just want to point out that listeners can go to classofcovid.org to see all the different stories. I want to highlight a couple of them here today. Reporter Carrie Sheridan of WUSF in Tampa looked at undocumented communities and their access to education, specifically farm workers. But how has, for this particular group, how has the pandemic impacted them? This is a group that's already underserved anyway.
Absolutely. So in this particular example, Carrie Sheridan of WUSF had been reporting on this issue before the pandemic. She was reporting on how difficult it is to make sure that the children of migrant farm workers, many of whom are undocumented immigrants from Mexico and Central America, that those children are able to get a free public education. It's their constitutional right. But there are so many barriers to that. And, you know, those include language barriers, you know, fears of deportation. And so sometimes parents are worried about, you know, putting their name on a piece of paper to register their kid for school because they think that, you know, that means they're going to get deported. And there's actually a federal program called the Migrant Education Program that was created in the 60s after a huge documentary came out, a really important landmark documentary from Edward R. Murrow about the extreme working conditions and poverty that were being faced by migrant farm workers, the people who are putting food on our tables. And then, you know, COVID-19 happens, and now we're talking about all of those problems being compounded by the fact that a lot of these people are living in like close cramped conditions. So, you know, obviously that gives COVID-19 a great opportunity to spread. And once families had experienced the horror of COVID-19 infections, they were that much more worried about sending their kids to school, but they may not have internet access or computers at home, you know?
And the film, by the way, you're talking about is The Harvest of Shame.
Harvest of Shame,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, 1960. You spoke with Anna Cranston Gingras, director of the Center for Migrant Education at the University of South Florida. Let's take a listen.
The government recognized that children from migrant backgrounds were dropping out of school at alarming rates. In fact, for many years, they were called the most disadvantaged group of students in the United States.
You know, I mean, you said it yourself, Jess, that it's, I mean, that's in Hillsborough County, this story, but that's not just in Hillsborough County. That's happening a lot of places, keeping students having strong internet. You've been reporting about the issues here with students in South Florida not having good internet.
Yeah, and I would just quickly add that, you know, that Carrie's story focuses on Hillsborough County, but of course there are agricultural communities all over the state, and namely Immokalee, Belgrade, Homestead, you know, that are facing similar issues. And then, you know, beyond migrant farm worker families, many families are struggling with the internet access and the technology access. And one of another story that we have from Amy Green at WMFE in Orlando looks at Orange County, which includes Orlando, as well as Osceola County, which is a richly diverse district that is adjacent to Orange County, and where it was hit really hard by the layoffs that happened at the theme parks in Central Florida, because a lot of people who live there, that's where they work. And so now, you know, their children are facing those same economic concerns that their parents are facing. And of course, that's getting in the way of virtual learning.
Again, we're talking with WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman. The new series is called Class of COVID-19, an education crisis for Florida's vulnerable students. And it comes from Florida Public Media. You can hear the 1 hour special and read more by going to classofcovid.org. Just one of the powerful narratives came from students and staff at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Our Broward County reporter, Katie Swetolski-Munoz, spoke with Sarah Lerner, an English teacher and yearbook advisor. We've had her on the program. And she also heard from two students as well who were freshmen during the shooting. Here's the first voice we hear is from a young woman named Nicole Martin.
I went back to campus one time this year. And when I went back to campus, I immediately felt this stress, and I started to get a little bit like dizzy, and I was just dizzy. It just felt like I was kind of on edge the entire time I was on campus. And I realized that when I'm at home, I don't feel that. I feel a lot safer, and I don't feel like I'm in constant danger at home, I guess. I'm on edge of stress.
19 years, it feels like a lifetime, but then it also feels like 5 minutes. My name is Sarah Lerner. This is my 7th year at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School and my 19th year of teaching. After the incident at school, we were off. Like, it is such a blur to me.
Dizzy, dangerous.
My husband and my parents and, you know, friends did a lot to help me and help, you know, keep.
This story is powerful, important to us here in South Florida because it was in our backyard. But I'm wondering, Jess, you know, how did you connect it to this story of COVID?
Well, I think that quote that we just heard got a little bit cut off, but she was saying that, you know, her husband and family had helped to keep that ship afloat, her personal ship. And that's something that we've followed over the last 3 years. I can't believe it's been 3 years this coming Sunday since that shooting took place and 17 people were killed, 17 others were injured. And the seniors now were freshmen when that happened. Yeah. So this is a group of students who started their high school career with one of the deadliest school shootings in American history and is ending their high school career with a global pandemic, the likes of which we haven't seen in 100 years. So I really wanted to dig into those layers of trauma. And like we heard from Sarah Lerner, you know, there is a huge difference between the experience of recovering from the immediate aftermath of the shooting, because in those really difficult moments, teachers and students could lean on each other. They had each other to hug and cry and help each other, you know, get through. But in this case, now you're adding the isolation of the pandemic on top of that. People don't have that access to each other physically because of social distancing.
And of course, anyone who had the chance to listen, I mean, you just listened to that cut, but if you had the chance to listen this morning, you know, it's interesting because you're through production, you're trying to create a feeling of anxiety to help us understand what the students and teachers might be feeling. But I wanted to get a sense from you of you know, the way you approach this project, on a production level? What is it you're trying to do that you want the listeners to experience? What do you want them to take away?
Well, yes, you're right that we did something a little bit more creative audio-wise with that story. And we did want listeners to be able to feel that stress, that anxiety, and really empathize with the students and what they were going through.
This is not just for listeners, it's for readers and viewers, because this is a project that goes beyond just radio, beyond audio. What's next for the broadcast in the series?
Absolutely. Well, we want listeners and viewers of public radio and public television, consumers of our news products online, to be paying attention for the next month, because you're going to hear public affairs segments on programs all over the state, including this one. Mm-hmm. We will be exploring class of COVID-19 a little bit more on Sundial, also on the Sunshine Economy, which is our Monday morning business program. And we have a television program that's coming up later in February, the week of the 22nd. And also, we have a newsletter, which I would really, really like to encourage listeners who are interested in this topic, who want to know more, to sign up for, because we're going to be diving more deeply into the stories of the project, getting reporters' notebook-style observations from the journalists who are a part of the project to hear about, you know, what these stories mean to them, why they wanted to pursue the project, you know, the voices that they wanted to identify to tell these stories. And we'll also be rounding up the latest news and research regarding some of these topics. So there's a whole lot more to come, and you can find all of that at classofcovid.org.
And of course, like I said, if you missed out this morning's program, it airs again tonight at 7 o'clock. Go, as she said, to classofcovid.org. And yes, you know, we'll be talking about a lot of the other projects or other stories that you cover in this project on this program throughout this month. Again, WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman, always a pleasure. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And again, go to classofcovid.org for more on this project. Well, still to come, using psychedelic mushrooms and acid as a form of therapy. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Psychedelics, hallucinogens like magic mushrooms or LSD, have gotten a bad reputation over the years. That seems to be changing. Some experts say these substances are going through a renaissance, as access and medical research point to the positive effects these drugs can have on mental health in specific circumstances. Dr. Jerry B. Brown is a founding professor of anthropology at Florida International University, with 42 years of experience studying psychedelics. And by the way, he teaches a class on psychedelics and culture. Dr. Brown, it is a pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure as well. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to go back because you had an experience, a personal experience, I believe in the 70s, that really sparked your interest in psychedelics. What happened?
Well, what happened was I went to something called a Rainbow Family Gathering with some friends from Miami, which was kind of an early Burning Man high in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. And I had my first LSD experience, not knowing anything about dose, not knowing anything about integration, having guides or anything like that. And I didn't have what Leary and others were talking about, an enlightened experience, a vision of God. I was spun into a very paranoid world. And I realized after studying this further that this was a very bad time in my life to experiment with LSD, because I was on the verge of a divorce, and I had just left actually the farm workers movement, Cesar Chavez's movement, on which I had done my doctoral dissertation at Cornell University. So I was in a very unstable point in my life. Unlike Albert Hoffman, who discovered LSD in 1943, I didn't think I was dying, but I kind of felt that I was, you know, slipping away.
So it's interesting. And, you had a bad experience, and yet it launched you into wanting to understand psychedelics better.
Yeah, well, I'm a scientist, and I think all good science comes out of questions. And I wanted to understand, how could it be this powerful? Because I'd always prided myself on having control of my mind. And I started reading all of the research from the 50s and 60s. And there had been over 1,000 peer-reviewed papers with research showing promise of psychedelics in over 40,000 human subjects, which all got washed away in the 1970 passage of the Controlled Substance Act. So in reading this, I wanted to learn a lot more. And as they say, if you want to learn something, teach it. So being a professor of anthropology, I designed a course on psychedelics and culture, which I put into the catalog at FIU and started teaching annually since 1975. I'm told it's the first college level course on psychedelics anywhere in the world. And I continue teaching that course annually, and am now delighted to say that I'm back teaching again online.
Yeah, because you were, I mean, my understanding, right, you were retired for 7 years, and now you're back teaching it.
Well, I think retired is a little overstatement. What happened is after I formally retired from FIU after 42 years in 2014, my wife and I continued, because she's the co-author of our book, The Psychedelic Gospels, continued to research, write, and educate through podcasts, through virtual conferences, through blogs on this area of psychedelics, and including psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, which my wife Julie has insight into, having had a private therapy practice for many years.
Yeah. So I'm curious with the class, first of all, you know, the kind of interest that you get from students, you know, do they know what they're getting into before they get into that class?
I think, no. I think they're attracted to the idea of taking a course on psychedelics and culture. But as several of them have told me, Dr. Brown, I've never known about 97% of what you've taught us here in this class. For example, a lot of the knowledge that students, even in drug education classes, have today is miseducation. It comes from the first wave of psychedelic research. And, you know, there's a lot of urban legends. There's a lot of sensational, unsubstantiated news stories. So I try to set the record straight on this. And what a lot of people don't realize is that John Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's two top staff people from the Watergate days, confessed before his death that they knew that these drugs were not toxic, not addictive, could not, you know, drive you insane. Under most of the cases, it was very rare that people would have a psychotic break, but that they had two big political problems. One, an anti-war movement. Two, a civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Obviously, they couldn't make it illegal to protest, nor to be black. So they passed these laws, the Controlled Substances Act, so that they could infiltrate and arrest leaders in these movements.
And
in reality, adverse effects of psychedelics are usually short-lived. And on a list of what are the most dangerous drugs, I mean, alcohol is there as the most harmful, 10 times as harmful as mushrooms. So
let me jump in real quick though. I mean, yes, going back to Nixon too, is that you started to see the war on drugs. And so now it's just, you know, you're throwing a lot of things into one war. But the pushback I want to just throw on you here is this, as you said, you know, what drugs are more dangerous? Doesn't it depend though on, you know, the drugs itself, like who's making it, because they're still illegal. I mean, it's, how do you know what you're getting and if it's safe?
That is a huge risk. And I remember when I was teaching in Miami, there was a center in which people could drop off their drugs anonymously in Coconut Grove, have them tested. And 60% of the drugs that were brought in were not what people thought they were. Some of them were adulterated with PCP. Or speed. And so this is a huge problem for anyone thinking about trying drugs and not knowing that there's a pure source, as there is in clinical studies where they have a pharmaceutically manufactured synthetic substance of LSD or psilocybin or ecstasy, MDMA.
Yeah. Let me, because you talked about just a moment ago too, is kind of like the perception of, you know, that got latched on to, you know, a lot of these drugs. But let's talk about, I mean, specifically these psychedelics. What are some of the common misconceptions society has, and where do those come from? Because the first thing that popped in my mind is like pop culture, you know, like movies.
Oh, sure. I mean, you can go all the way back to the Reefer Madness movies that, you know, it would turn you insane. You can go back to the racist stereotypes of that time that African-Americans and Mexican-Americans were going to infiltrate your communities with these dangerous drugs. But in reality, according to David Nutt, who was the chairman, a chemist, the chairman of the England's Drug Misuse Council, and it's, I quote him, it's virtually impossible to die from an overdose of them, the classical psychedelics. They cause no physical harm. And in a way, they're actually anti-addictive, because if you took one and you take another dose, it would probably have very little effect. That's not to say that these are not dangerous for people who are emotionally unstable, for people who have fragile egos, for people who have a history definitely of chronic mental illness. It is definitely not recommended. But the clinical research that's going on today screens for that. And in fact, Lewis, we've come so far that there is a Florida lawmaker who is hoping to follow Oregon and has proposed a piece of legislation to legalize medical mushrooms for psychotherapy processes. And yeah, he's introduced a piece of legislation. That's Representative Michael Grieco.
Yeah. And I want to get to, you know, the really perceptions for the future. Just want to mention again, I'm talking with Dr. Jerry B. Brown, the founding professor of anthropology at FIU, where he designed and teaches a course on hallucinogens and culture. And over the years, this course has evolved, as has the research around psychedelics. And you can find more information about the course being offered at FIU on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You can also find more about Dr. Brown's work on psychedelic gospels on the Facebook channel. Again, just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Brown, about that. You co-authored a book with your wife. It's titled The Psychedelic Gospels, The Secret History of Hallucinogens in Christianity. All right. So yes. I don't remember anything being taught in the Bible about hallucinogens, or did I miss something?
Yeah. And you didn't hear anything taught about Santa Claus either in the Bible. And he's a perfect representative of a red and white Amanita mushroom. But essentially what happened was, teaching this course for, 30 years, I was in agreement, I had accepted the predominant opinion that there was no evidence of psychedelics in the Bible after Genesis, after 1,000 years before Christ. On a anniversary trip to Scotland, we visited Rosalind Chapel, attracted there by its mention in Dan Brown's bestseller, The Da Vinci Code. And I saw there sculpted into this Catholic church an Amanita muscaria mushroom. So, and that's the red and white mushrooms that you see in fairy tales. You see it around Santa Claus. You see it in Scandinavian folk tales with little elves dancing around it. It's a very powerful psychoactive mushroom that's been used since time immemorial by the reindeer herders of Siberia and was brought into India by the ancient Aryans. And when Julie and I discovered this, we said, what's going on here? Was there a psychoactive ritual here? Was this something that was used further in medieval Christianity? Oh my goodness, could this even go back to the early Eucharist and the time of the disciples? And before we got carried away by this kind of rambunctious overthrow of reason, I remember the words of Carl Sagan, the astrophysicist, who said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so after wrestling with this for several years, we came to a point, Lewis, where we realized that given what we knew, and I was able to identify that mushroom because I'd studied mushroom identification as part of learning what I needed to learn to teach this course, we said we would regret it the rest of our lives if we don't go out and research this. And in 2012, we traveled throughout Europe and the Middle East to churches and cathedrals, and we found multiple evidence of psychoactive mushrooms, both Amanita muscaria and psilocybin varieties, in Christian art, in illuminated manuscripts, prayer books, mosaics, frescoes, and the like. But we published this in our book, The Psychedelic Gospels, and that's one of two books that we use in the course, along with best-selling authors Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind.
Yeah.
He's done a great deal to bring this psychedelic renaissance into the forefront, being not only a best-selling author, but also named as one of the most 100 influential people in the country.
And we talked to him on the show. I don't see this being discussed in Sunday school anytime soon, but you say psychedelics are experiencing a second act. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, after what happened here, and is that that in 2006, an eminent drug researcher, Dr. Roland Griffiths at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, who was already well established in his career as an addiction researcher, had 300 peer-reviewed papers to his credit, out of meditation became interested in psychedelics. And starting in 2006, Johns Hopkins did a series of double-blind controlled studies, the kind that you have to go through for FDA approval. And their first paper was they proved that psilocybin could be safely administered to healthy people in a clinical setting with supportive guides, and that the majority of the people had a very positive mood-improving experience that lasted over a year.
Because I know there's a lot of research that you can point to. I just want to get to this, though. This is what I'm curious about is it seems like over the last 10 years, we've seen this push to make marijuana, first medical marijuana legal, but then recreational marijuana legal. And we've seen a lot of states now start to go in that direction. We've just seen attitudes of people, especially those who were anti-drug at one point, now accept it. Like, yeah, this is good stuff. It's good for life. It's good for health. It's good for illness. Do you see that happening with, say, mushrooms and with other psychedelics, like that people are going to, the attitudes in society will be like, yeah, you know what? This is not a big deal. Let's make it legal.
Absolutely. Not only do I see it happening, it is happening. And as with cannabis, legalization and decriminalization follows medicalization. So as people become aware through programs like this, through Michael Pollan's book, through research published in the New York Times, that psychedelics can help people overcome depression, anxiety, for advanced cancer patients, fear of death, for first responders and war veterans to overcome post-traumatic stress disorder. And mind you, in one or two sessions, that as people realize this, the attitudes are shifting. And therefore, you've seen decriminalization in Denver, Oakland, Ann Arbor, Washington, D.C., and Oregon in the last election, presidential election, by 56% of the vote passed the Psilocybin Services Initiative that makes it legal for medical use approved by a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
I want to ask you just to finish up here briefly in 30 seconds. Would you recommend, I've never tried one, would you recommend that someday I should?
I do not recommend to you or my students anything about use. However, if you're thinking about it, I suggest you look at Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, because he experimented with LSD and psilocybin with guides as part of his research for the book. And I just, if you want to learn more about it, my class will be offered again next spring 2022, and I'd love to have you there.
He is Dr. Jerry B. Brown, founding professor of anthropology at Florida International University, and he does teach a class on this, hallucinogens and culture. Dr. Brown, it's been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate the time.
The pleasure's mine. Thank you so much.
And by the way, you can find more information about that course that he's talking about offered at FIU on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And you can find out more about Dr. Brown's work at psychedelicgospels.com. And that's our program for this Monday, February 8th. Coming up tomorrow, we are following the scheduled impeachment hearings for former President Trump. It begins tomorrow. We'll bring you live coverage from NPR when they begin, and we'll keep you updated online and through newscasts. You can always find old episodes of Sundial. Remember, just go to WLRN.org/Sundial. By the way, just to mention, don't forget that we are, for this month, in our Sundial Book Club, we are reading Swamplandia by Karen Russell. Are you folks enjoying it? I was doing a lot of reading over the weekend. Fascinating story. It's a wild journey through the Everglades. It's really a good book. If you are reading it or want to know more, go to our Facebook page, Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. We're going to be talking with the author later this week, so if you've got questions for her, post them there, and I'll get it to her. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live soon.